Hello and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Feature. I'm your host, Tom Majeure, and today we're going to talk about oak wilt. But we're going to be talking with one of the Forest Service agents, and I'm so pleased to have him today. His name is Eric Brandon. Eric, welcome to Strong Tower Radio Feature.
Hey, thank you so much. It's great to be here. Do that.
Fantastic. But we're here to talk about oak wilt, and let's start with a word of prayer. Our great Heavenly Father, I just want to thank you for the opportunity. We are stewards, and when you put Adam and Eve in the garden, they were to tend that garden with loving, tender care. It was a beautiful environment where there was no oak wilt. But Lord, there's sin in the world, and we have to deal with this until you come again. But until then, help us to be good stewards and be with Eric and I as we talk about this important subject and what we, as stewards of the forest, can do. In Jesus' name, amen. Eric, you know, oak wilt is our topic, but we've had such a wonderful time talking with, it started with the U.S. Forest Service on our side of the state, the west side of the state, we've talked to so many experts in the field, and tell us about the Forest Service. You have an awesome story about why the Forest Service is in the agricultural department of the United States government rather than the Interior Department, and it's a good story.
Well, this goes back to the late 1800s. Teddy Roosevelt was president. And he with some very dedicated individuals to stewardship, as you just mentioned, and looking toward wood supply for the future and clean water coming down out of the mountains. The first forest reserves were created. That's land that had never been in any other ownership except the U.S. government, and they said, okay, these are forest reserves designed to supply timber for the country and to provide flows of clean water. That was pretty much written down just like that. And at the time, they were put under the management of the Bureau of Department of Interior, I believe. That's how you say that. And at the time, in the western states, that's where all those reserves were made. You know, Montana, Wyoming, California, Oregon, Washington, the first forest reserves. Things weren't always on the up and up, I guess I'll say. You know, and it was kind of ran as some timber companies' private timberlands that they wanted to go cut it. They just got to go cut it and cut the best and leave the rest. Management before the turn of the century, you know, forestry was an unheard of practice in America before the turn of the century. It was pretty much cut and move on. And there was a lot of maybe under the table stuff going on out west with the Bureau of Interior and the timber interests. And the people who were instrumental in creating those forest reserves worked like heck to remedy the situation. And it turned out that the remedy was to place those forest reserves in an entirely different federal agency, which was the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So that's how we became the USDA Forest Service, I think.
And there was these wise men who, you know, they had these, the U.S. came in to probably purchase those tracts of land, and it wasn't making the expectations. And so sometimes the first try requires a second try to get it right. And it's just wonderful what the Forest Service is doing today. Tell us, your job is timber management. So that's a subset of the U.S. Forest Service. What are the different divisions of the Forest Service besides the timber management?
Well, there's timber management and recreation management are the main two splits, rec and timber. And then there's ecology, wildlife, fire, which are divisions that support both recreation and the timber management as well.
Boy, this sounds a lot like the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. You know, personally, growing up, all we knew was the state parks. But there's much, much more involved than that, as we've learned, as our listeners can go back through the files or have heard on our programs, that there's fire management and wildlife management. Actually, the Parks Department is a smaller part than most people realize.
Well, I would certainly agree with that. You know, rec has its seasons, you know, big time in the summers, kind of slacking off in the winter a little bit, and timber's running pretty much year round at full capacity. I'm responsible for the timber sales that go out on my ranger district. If there's timber put up for sale, it's been looked at by archaeologists to identify any heritage sites that could be there. Ecologists to identify any plants, special plants, or even endangered or threatened plants that might be there, and how we would mitigate those instances, and also wildlife looking at it to do the same thing with any threatened and endangered species, and any special species that the whole forest is concerned with, that might not be threatened and endangered, but we're concerned about them because they might be heading that way.
Right.
You know, so speaking of like management for other timber management for wildlife, especially, we're really into on the east side of the Huron Manistee. So it's basically two forests. It's the Huron National Forest, which I think was established in 1906, and the Manistee National Forest, which was established in 23. And they were both combined into one administrative unit in the early 40s. So that's how we became the Huron Manistee National Forest. So on the, you know, it's east of 75 and west of 75, right? So
okay,
that's very different sites, very different soils, very different kinds of timber. You know, we on the Huron side of the forest, the Huron side of the National Forest. You know, of course, all the forests in the east were not forest reserves; they were created, but because there was a willing seller, and the Department of Ag was the willing buyer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so speaking for the Huron National Forest, it was cut over and burnt, and nobody wanted it.
Okay.
You know, so that's the history of this side of the forest is almost complete devastation, and then burning at least once, many times, two or three times. We got extensive plantings by the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, in the late 20s, early 30s. Through the 30s, in fact, and we're still harvesting those stands today, and we're planting back some of those stands all the time, so that 80, 90 years from now, people are still cutting timber out there. So, and we do a lot of management for the Kirkland warbler. That's a bird that winters in the Bahamas and nests up in right here in northern Michigan. In our jack pine stands, and the thing about the Kirkland warbler, back in the 80s, the entire population of the Kirkland warbler would fit in a bread bag.
Wow. Right?
Threatened and endangered in the 80s, and today, in fact, 2 years ago, it was delisted from the threatened and endangered species list, and it's because of the certain way we cut the timber to get young jack pine growing back, which the Kirkland warbler, that's we call it critical habitat. They have to have jack pine that's between 5 and 15 years old to nest under. And if they don't have it, they're not successful nesters. So we always have a checkerboard pattern of that 5 to 15-year-old jack pine out there, enough acres to satisfy our Kirkland warbler acres that we feel we need to have going for habitat for them to remain delisted, a viable species. So that's really quite the success story here on the Huron side of the forest is our forest management specifically aimed at Kirkland warbler habitat.
Well, kudos to you and your team and landowners who work together to bring the Kirkland warblers. We went up to look at them in the about the 1976, 77, 78. And so I have a kind of a bond with the Kirtland Warblers. So the success story, I've lived and applauded it. Hey, let's turn to Oakwell in the second half of our program. What is Oakwell? Why don't you give us kind of an outline, Eric, of what you think we might find of most interest about this Oakwell? You've shared a little bit with me, but it's scary, but it also has the opportunity it can be dealt with.
Well, sounds great. Here we go. Hold on to your seats, boys and girls. Oak wilt is a fungus, a fungal disease. Has a big, long Latin name that nobody's going to remember. I'm not going to bother with that. And what it does is it plugs up all the plumbing pipes of the tree. Right?
Okay.
Nothing comes up, nothing goes down, all the pipes are plugged up. When that happens in the house, right, the toilet starts overflowing, nothing to go down, right, and no water's coming out the faucet. And the tree actually appears to wilt. The affected tree's leaves usually turn brown and start to fall off, actually. If you're underneath a tree affected by oak wilt, it could be like the height of summer, certainly like late August, September, everything's still green. And you're underneath a tree and there's always two or three leaves in the air falling. Like not an instant, like the whole tree leaves fall off, but always going on around the clock. And in 30 days or so, most of the leaves have fallen off the tree. It's a very fast acting disease. It's fatal to red oaks. The red oaks in our area are northern red oak, pin oak, down probably in the Baldwin unit. They might even have some scarlet oak reaching up to the north, and of course black oak that we have. White oaks can get infected, but usually survive. White oaks have a certain particular cell structure called a tyloses is the Latin name for the textbook name for that certain cell structure. And that's what makes white oak waterproof, right? That's why that's the whiskey barrels and the champagne barrels and ships of the line were all made out of white oak because it's the only hardwood in North America that's waterproof. And it has the ability to use that waterproof nature in its cells to wall off the fungus and keep it isolated from the rest of the tree. That's why white oak seems to live with it. It may survive for a long time, and it may succumb in 4 or 5 years. I haven't really seen it a lot in white oak, but that's what the textbooks say about it. The incidence of oak wilt has greatly increased in recent years, and you can see it following the recreation corridors.
Okay.
And so that means, like, I'm thinking that infected firewood is getting moved around. Right, so, hey, there's a dead oak tree out there. Let's cut it down and make wood. I would.
Yep.
I don't. Who wouldn't? Right. But there's a couple ways to go about that I'll get into in just a minute. Let me back up just a little bit first, though, and how it spread. Okay. It's a fungus. So how does it spread around and get to other trees? Okay. The first way is called the overland spread. The fungus, being a fungus, it wants to make a fruiting body, you know, like if you think of mushrooms are fungus, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it does produce, scientists don't like me calling it this, but it oak wilt fungus produces a mushroom. They call it a spore pad or a fungal mat. It doesn't really look like a mushroom you buy in a store to eat. It's basically an oak wilt mushroom or a pressure pad or spore mat, they call it. Use the right terminology on the radio here.
Mm-hmm.
It can be up to the size of a playing card and even a little bit smaller. And it's usually football shaped. And it's, people will be wanting to look to look up, and there's several excellent pictures around. I'll be able to recommend some websites to go look at some pictures of it. So a tree that got killed by oak wilt, the last thing the fungus does is feed off all the carbohydrates and sugars that are left in that tree, and it produces that spore pad because it's wanting to reproduce and spread its spores around, right?
Right.
Okay, so the way it does this is the spore pad occurs between the bark and the wood, in that space between the bark and the wood. Now, the tree is dead, so the bark gets all loosened up on a dead tree. You probably notice bark. Mm-hmm. Bark flaking off, the dead ash around. Well, it does the same thing. And so that mushroom forms underneath the bark, and it actually pops the bark out a little bit so the bark cracks. Okay? So it's kind of in a carport because it's protected by the bark, but it has access to the outside world because it's cracked the bark. Now, this oak wilt mushroom spore pad smells just like apple cider that's been in the icebox about 2 weeks too long. It's starting to ferment. If I smell it, it's kind of one of those smells. If you smell it in the morning, I smell it all day. You know, it's unmistakable. Okay, but there's several beetle species. The genus is Nidadulid. There's several beetle species that are really attracted to those fruiting smells. They're called sap beetles, in fact, the common name. One of their favorite things is those fruity smells, and they're drawn right to that spore pad, what I'm calling this really small miniature mushroom spore pad. They're attracted to that. They can get into the crack in the bark and crawl all over it, feeding on it. And then when they fly off with the spores on their little bodies. Right? They don't know they're doing that. They're just doing their beetle thing. And they being attracted to fruity smells, and it turns out they're the vector, overland vector for this fungus. Because the other thing these beetles are very attracted to is oak, the smell of fresh oak sap. I don't know if you ever split oak firewood or done some sawing in oak, but fresh green oak wood has a very distinctive smell.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And an injured tree, when the sap is running, that the sap's running out of it after it gets injured, or somebody nicks the bark off of the boat trailer, backing it into the garage, or ill-timed pruning out in the yard, and the sap's running, and these beetles, just like going to Dairy Queen for them, right? I mean, they're off, and it's claimed they smell it from a mile to 2 miles away with their little antennas. They're all hustling toward that injured oak. Now, if these beetles have recently been crawling around on that oak wilt spore pad, they have those spores on their body. They crawl around sucking up the sap on the oak wound, you know, maybe a tree a mile away. And in effect, they inoculate that tree with the fungal spores, and it takes off from there. So that's the overland spread. It's by insect vectors picking up spores on their body, and then crawling around on an injured oak tree and introducing those spores into the system.
So what's the other vector?
So the other vector is underground. So it turns out that oak trees, especially red oak trees, have everybody hooked up underneath the ground. There's root grafts going on where they're actually exchanging nutrients and fluids from tree to tree through their root system. If two oak wilt different trees' roots are growing side by side, the term is they irritate each other enough and they grow together and become one. And so after the weakness that we exploit to stop oak wilt fungus, its only weakness, I think, is that it cannot survive for very long in dead tissue. It has to have live tissue to survive, okay? So it doesn't want to be underground. It wants to be above ground to kill the tree, eat its carbohydrates and sugars, and produce a mushroom, produce spores, and spread around. But it will die. It will retreat into the root system, follow all the root systems, eventually find grass to the next tree, and make its way to the next tree, up into the tree, kill that, retreat back into the root system, travel the root system, find another live tree, go up into that tree, kill it, retreat into the root system, rinse and repeat, right? And so what it be, and it becomes in a circle. It's not linear. It's all around in the circle because the roots are all around in a circle. And so you'll see it spreading in that circular pattern. We call it the circle of death, ever-widening circle of death, where the original tree is perhaps infected from overland spread. Maybe a dead ash fell during a wind event and knocked a limb off that oak tree, and a beetle with the oak wilt fungus spores on its body was feeding on its wound and infected that tree. And so that's how it starts. It kills that tree, goes into the roots, and searches for other tree, oak trees that that oak tree is connected to underground. It's all a vast interconnected highway with exit ramps and interstate, the whole signpost thing going on underground. And that's 80% of the spread is underground.
So, Eric, how do we solve this problem? How do we cure this problem?
I think I said before that there's no cure, but we can stop it. We can stop it from advancing. Of course, the best cure is prevention, right? Then you don't have to get into anything. And that, let me just say that by avoiding injury to the trees when the beetles are active, the beetles that spread the spores around are active, and also when the tree phenology and the tree biochemistry makes this middle of April to the middle of July, that's the critical times when what we call the high-risk season for oak wilt. If there's an injury on an oak tree during those times and there's beetles flying around with spores on their body from a nearby tree within a mile or two, that's a good chance that that tree could get infected. So prevention is the key. But moving on from that, say we have an oak wilt situation. If you notice that this individual tree, say a tree is infected overland like we talked about from the beetle spreading the spores around, we catch that individual tree as it's wilting, we can cut the tree down and excavate the stump before it's allowed to spread through the roots to nearby trees. I've used that with quite a bit of success through the years, and I've seen like Higgins Lake State Park is using that as well with great success. That's the individual stump excavation. And the other way is, say, I've come on several sites where I described the circle of ever-widening circle of death is going on. A tree was an individual specimen was infected overland that died. The fungus migrated through the root systems to live trees nearby that were grafted in. And it killed them, and then it spreads to more grafted trees, you know, and the circle keeps getting wider. So we kind of try to think of it like a wildfire that's spreading underground. And what we do, we light a backfire so it can't burn any more fuel. And by that, we basically mechanically separate those root grafts. And
you dig a trench or something?
We dig a trench. Now, there's several ways to go about that trench, and we recommend that it's 5 feet deep. There's really good science behind this, where if you follow the cookbook recipe, you're 98% confident you're going to stop it. So there's a cookbook recipe to follow. We have good information, good science saying how far away is that tree how far away does that tree have to be before it's not grafted anymore? And so we have a regression table we go by that's based on the tree diameter. Like this tree is infected with oak wilt. It's 12 inches diameter. There's a tree over there, 12 inches diameter. Is that grafted? Well, we measured the distance between the two based on the diameters. I had the diameter of the infected tree, the diameter of the tree. I'm wondering if it's going to get infected or not. So 12 and 12, 12 inches, 12 inch. Add those two diameters, and I can look up in the table that 24 inches, how far away that tree has to be. So I go out those distance on every tree that's infected around that circle of death, and I put what I'm trying to do is put the site for that trench line in based on science, not just say, well, I'll put the trench line over here. You know, if you're going to do all that work and invest that time, we want to make sure that you get the job done, and that's the great science that we have. Some of the only really good science we have for oak wilt is that distance of grafting distance. So I'll set the trench line location based on that science of who's probably grafted to who. 98% confident that you're not grafted or that you are, and I'll set my trench line in a circle around that area accordingly. So there's a 5 foot vibratory trenching tool that doesn't really dig up any dirt. It just vibrates. You see them out on the job laying cable on the side of the road. That's what that is. It's a vibrating plow laying cable behind it. It's like shaking the ground so the cable can be installed at 5 foot depth. Well, it's a great root cutter too, and it'll go around boulders a little bit and jump over them, and so you can use that vibratory plow along your trench, that area that we decided on, or you can use. I've used everything from giant track hose to little like residential plumbing backhoes, you know, that are really small and get in between two houses. And,
sure.
And it's, you don't have to leave the trench open. The trench can be filled in immediately. In fact, we put the first couple scoops off to the side, and we dig back toward the machine and fill in as we dig. You're not trying to dig a trench. You're trying to cut the roots, and you're using the trench to cut the roots, you know, the trencher to cut the roots. So you can fill the hole back in immediately, just so the roots are cut. So you've created an island, right? That the fungus can't penetrate.
Wow. Well, Eric, we're coming to the end of this segment here. Can you summarize points of action? We've heard that from April 15th to, was it July 15th,
mm-hmm.
that we avoid injuring oak trees, particularly the white ones.
The red ones.
Everything but the we do that. Plus, there's intervention, which you've just described there. Some of us have been a little slow on conforming on transporting of firewood. I can see that this must be much more important than many of us realize how dangerous transporting firewood is.
You know how we talked about how that oak that was killed by the oak wilt fungus will make that fruiting body of spore pads. Well, it will do it as a standing tree in the woods, or it'll do it as a log in your firewood pile.
Wow.
It can be cut up, made into firewood, and it'll still pop mushrooms underneath the bark on those logs in the firewood pile.
Wow.
You know, so I can take it to several camps where they brought in infected firewood, piled it up against an oak tree, and wondered why the three or four oak trees died, you know. So that's, and if I didn't know about it, I'd do the same thing. You know, that's, programs like this are so essential to get that word out. If nothing else, just for that. You know, if the firewood is dry enough that the bark is falling off, it's safe to move anywhere.
Really? Okay.
Yes. So no worries after that. You know, if people that cut down oak wilt infected trees, the recommendation, if they're going to use it for firewood, you don't have to throw it away. You know, the recommendation is to chip it, bury it, or burn it, right? I mean, so to get it. And the other way is to tarp that. Go ahead and make your firewood out of it, and then tarp that firewood pile completely over. And I make sure the tarp goes all the way to the ground, and I throw dirt and other chunks of wood on it to seal it off. You're trying to deny access to the beetle. It's going to make a mushroom, but you don't want the beetle to get access to that mushroom.
Wow.
Well, so that's the idea behind that.
Thank you so much, Eric, for the opportunity, and we'll be wiser consumers and better stewards of the forest. Eric Brandon is the Timber Management Assistant for the Huron-Manistee National Forest. Thank you so much for being a part of our program today.
Well, I sure appreciate you having me on and the opportunity to get the word out about oak wilt a little bit. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Strong Tower Radio Feature. I'm your host, Tom Majeure. Bye now.